Just for the historic record, could you take your graduation?
Sure. My full name is Thomas P. Glynn III, and I was in the class of 1968.
Great. And what's your hometown, Tom? Okay. Make sure this is clicking on. Okay, it is. So I'm going to just dive in, because I figure we're talking about an era of change and unrest and dissatisfaction. What were your, how would you sum up your beliefs at that juncture, at your junior, senior year at Tufts? I mean, what was going through your mind at that time? What were you agitated about?
I think the main thing that we were focused on was the civil rights movement and how that applied to the North, how it applied to universities in the North, and what role universities in the North could play. Obviously, by junior, senior year, a lot had already happened. When I'm leaving here, I'm going to an event for John Lewis, who I did not know, when I was a student, but he had obviously done a lot of the work that he had done before we were here. So that was, a big component. And then Martin Luther King had announced the Poor People's March, which took place in the spring of 68, even though he had been assassinated. So that was another kind of building block, I think, of concern. And then, obviously, the war in Vietnam was another piece of people's dissatisfaction.
What are the roots of your activism? Was your family the activist?
No, that's a great question. No, so my dad went to Tufts, graduated in the class of 1936, majored in chemistry, went on to do some graduate work in chemistry, and then worked for the same company, Lever Brothers, for basically 40 years, first in Cambridge, then he was transferred to Baltimore, then he was transferred to New Jersey, so went to high school in New Jersey. And he was, pretty much of somebody who organized his life around his family and his work and didn't really have any involvements in social justice. And my mother in that era was a quote-unquote stay-at-home mother. So, I obviously had some influence from my parents, but it wasn't an activist influence. I think, it seems like ancient history, but, President Kennedy, the Peace Corps, became a VISTA volunteer when I graduated. So that was probably as much of an influence in terms of the kind of awakening of a generation of young people as anything in my kind of household.
What specifically did you zone in on and did you fight for? I mean, were there activities or were there...
I think a couple of things. In the context of the civil rights movement, I was particularly interested in the issue of urban poverty.
Okay.
So that manifested itself in a couple of ways. So one is I was on the board of the ex-college. Two is I taught a freshman seminar my senior year on urban poverty. Third, in a sense to prepare for that, I took a course at the Cambridge Center for Adult Education in urban poverty, which obviously was not for credit. I just wanted to learn more. And the person who taught the course was a woman named then Joanne Ross, later Joanne Ross Barboza. And her background was she was working for the state in the state-run kind of VISTA program called Commonwealth Service Corps. But she had lived in the Columbia Point Housing Project for 11 years and had been on welfare for 13 years. So I thought it would be a good idea if she taught a course at Tufts. So the ex-college was the appropriate vehicle. So she taught a 4-credit course at Tufts in the spring, I think, of 68. And then I think she taught into the next year after I was gone. Very popular course if you have as part of your interviews, do you interview Alan Solomon? He was one of her students.
Excellent.
And he talks a lot about that. So so that was, kind of a big focus. Secondarily was the kind of reaction to the Martin Luther King assassination and shouldn't there be more black students at Tufts? There were some. By that time, I think Charles Yancey was already on campus as a freshman. And, you know, what about financial aid? And there was some discussion in that context about investment policies. Mm-hmm. You know, should we be investing in Georgia Power and Light, which, in fairness, was presumed to be part of the Old South. I don't know if that was really true. So that was a lot of it. I was working my senior year, my work-study job. I was assigned to the East Boston North Suffolk Mental Health Center. Because by that time I was already kind of interested in the social work part of. So that was my work-study job for that year.
Had you get work-study through Tufts?
Or? Yeah.
I don't know if they do that anymore. Okay. Yeah. Outside the university?
Well, they placed me outside, yeah.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
And they were very generous to me in my senior year. That was, you know, my sister started as a freshman at Syracuse. So Tufts was expensive. Syracuse was expensive. You know, my family was okay. But so they made it, you know, they gave me a very good financial aid package. So that wasn't as much of a stress as it might have been. But I was assigned to the North Suffolk Mental Health Center. And I worked with a group of boys on Tuesday and an individual boy on Fridays. But oddly enough, you know, 44 years later, I end up running the airport, which is in East Boston, and I have interactions with the North Suffolk Mental Health Center, so you never know. So that was another component, and I tried organizing kind of an East Boston component of the Leonard Carmichael Society. Mm. You know, in those days, the focus, you know, poverty meant African-American. And there was just kind of an awakening that there were other, you know, white neighborhoods that had similar challenges in terms of economic opportunity. So that was kind of why that was, what that was about. So that was, you know, I think a reasonable sample of
stuff.
Did
you feel solidarity in that effort? Were there other students?
Oh, yeah.
There was an issue, I think poverty, I mean, Lyndon Johnson had obviously...
Yeah, they launched the War on Poverty.
It was
active. You know, Vista was created. Head Start had been created.
You know,
the community action programs have been created. There was all those things were active. And as I said, the state was kind of modeling some mini versions. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really any controversy.
It wasn't like, you can't do that. It was...
No. I mean, I think one of the important things about that era at Tufts versus other universities, including some in the eastern Massachusetts neighborhood, was tolerance, kind of embracing what do we have to learn from these kids. And, you know, the ex-college was kind of the beginning of that, which was before I got here, President Wessel. But that was kind of predicated on the idea that change is a good thing. And I think that was, you know, my experience with all the administrators. You know, President Hollowell had been really brought in as a financial guy to try to straighten out the finances. But, you know, he was very reasonable to work with. Mm-hmm. The Al Ullman, who was the provost, was very reasonable to work with. So, you know, they wanted to kind of figure it out.
Right.
And kind of learn and... You know, we didn't have kind of some of the same issues that they had on the campuses later in the 70-71 period. That was a little bit different. But in this period...
It's ironic in a way. It gets more rigid sometimes later on rather than...
Yeah, well, there was more, you know, a little bit of a different... It was the construction of the dorms and African-American not being well represented. And so, I mean, I wasn't here, so I can't really comment, but I... Sometimes this period gets sort of smushed into confusion, and we're just having breakfast with Saul, and there is a 5-year period, but 67 versus 72, pretty different. Hmm. Even though, you know, if you're writing a history, that might be a couple pages. But
68, how would you define its distinctive character?
You know, I would say it was the awakening of activism. Again, you know, I mean, Tufts, I had transferred, this is an important part of this, I had transferred from BC. So Tufts didn't have a lot of the rules and regulations that a lot of other places did. BC being maybe extreme example in the sense of kind of student life management. But so there was, it started off as a more tolerant mm-hmm. situation, whether that's because of the Unitarian Church or President mm-hmm. Wessel or,
Yeah, very different.
Yeah, so I would say that was an awakening, but it was an awakening in the context of tolerance, not reaction or overreaction.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, people seem to me to want to kind of learn from it and listen.
Nice.
And not assume that the students were just students.
And the Vietnam War?
So that was, that was happening all through that period. I would say most of the activity around that, though, happened off campus.
Oh. I had a picture. I'm trying to find it now. With Hallowell, I think there was a protest but that wasn't...
The one I remember at Ballou was about Martin Luther King.
Oh, okay.
And then there's one in front of his house, which was the night of the senior dinner. But I think that was more civil rightsy than...
Okay, my error.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, because the big demonstrations were either on Boston Common or in Washington. Not
right.
So much, because what's the symbolic...
Can't do anything on the Hill,
yeah.
Right?
A lot of stuff happened at Harvard. And so, to the extent people from Tufts were interested in what was going on in the anti-war movement, that was there was a lot going on there. But in terms of actual, I'm not saying it wasn't discussed, I'm not saying it wasn't controversial in terms of conversations, but most of the activities, because what Tufts could do something about was civil rights. Tufts couldn't really do.
So why? Civil rights. I mean, talk a little more about that and the heat that, I think it gathered heat and momentum over the, why do you think that?
Well, just because that's what was happening in society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was on the news, not that everybody was watching TV every night, but, it was the big change that was happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, people had their own. I grew up in three different places because of my dad being transferred. But basically, even in Baltimore, we lived in Baltimore County. They were segregated,
yeah.
The effort of part of some of the civil rights leaders, A, to make the North wake up,
mm-hmm.
and then B, at the end of his life with the Poor People's March and... one of my VISTA assignments was really to connect with low-income white neighborhoods. So it was just what was happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. You didn't have to manufacture it. It was on the front page of the New York
mm-hmm.
Times,
mm-hmm.
And what people were talking about. But, I think with a lot of the stuff that gets written in Time Magazine or Newsweek or something, there's a little bit of a tendency to kind of overstate. Probably 90%, 85%, we'll say, of the students were students going to class, doing their homework, taking exams,
mm-hmm.
aware of these issues. But it wasn't like the whole campus was,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's true everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, what was the news was those mm-hmm. activities. And so that tended to get a lot of attention. But it would be, I think, a surprise to, if you interviewed everybody in my class, a lot of folks would talk about kind of their academic involvement as opposed to
Did you feel that you were able to be heard at Tufts?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, with the administration, with the faculty, I don't remember ever having a harsh conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we were doing things with the president and the provost and the faculty, and I knew faculty from being on the ex-college board.
I heard you had some ambivalence about being named Mr. Tufts.
Well, when you interview my friend Judy Mears, you can whipsaw her on this. So, as I remember this, which recently somebody had a different theory, but as I remember it, in those days, Mr. Tufts was picked by a panel of three students. The editor of the newspaper, the editor of the magazine, which was then Barbara Harmon, who was... You may not know who she is, but if you've ever heard of Harmon Kardon,
Oh, okay.
That was her dad.
Okay.
She was a full professor at Wellesley College in English for like 40 years.
Yeah.
And then the third person was the president of student council, who was a woman named Betsy Harris, who married, I think her last name now is Lipschutz. So those three people. So Judy was part of this idea, well, we're going to show the Tufts as part of the mainstream of social justice. We're going to...
Okay.
So that got decided. Then Judy had an editorial written saying, I shouldn't accept. I don't remember that I was the one who was involved. Which was, you know, I mean, she was making a point. Which was, you know, you are capitalizing on a very small component of social justice commitment, but that doesn't really reflect everything that's going on here. So as a result, she published the editorial the day of the award. So that created some uncertainty among the public, the Tufts public. But
whether or not you would indeed
accept. And, I mean, I don't know how much you want to get into the gory details about this, but the actual thing they give you is the George Stuart Miller Award, which is Miller Hall. So George Stuart Miller refused to appear and give me the award because... So I think President Hall will give it to me. So, you know, I mean...
Again, oh, so that was like that was interesting that he must have felt...
Well, I wasn't... I mean, every other person who had gotten the award for the previous X years was captain of the football team, head of the Interfraternity Council, and, you know, Phi Beta Kappa. Well, I was over three on that score. So, I mean, I understand. He felt it wasn't... In a way, he and Judy agreed that that didn't really reflect what Tufts was at that moment in history.
When you did accept it, how did you feel about that?
You know, I wasn't used to getting awards. I was telling these guys at breakfast, if we're into this. So I was a transfer student.
Right, that's
so
true.
I transferred in the middle of my sophomore year. So second semester of sophomore year, I lived in Miller Hall with a roommate who was in the engineering school, who was a great guy. Junior year, I lived in Carmichael Hall in a single. And the fourth year, this was another thing that was part of the poverty thing, so I convinced the financial aid office, even though it was against the rules, if you had financial aid, you had to live on campus, because they didn't want to be exporting, you know, Tufts dollars on it. But they let me live in the South End, because I said I can't teach a course on urban poverty and be living in, you know, a dorm. So for all 2.5 years that I was here, I wasn't really that connected with the residential community. So I'm told I'm getting this award. So I was up in the office of the Experimental College writing a few things. And I came downstairs and I said, geez, I better get Lifesavers on me because I'm not used to giving speeches. And so I go in the bookstore and there's the cashier and there's Bernie Harleston. And I'm here. Here's Bernie, here's the cashier. Here's the pile of the Tufts, whatever it was called, weekly. So Bernie Harleston asked the cashier, standing 6 inches away, and there's a giant picture of me on the front page, who won Mr. Tufts this year? And she says, oh, some guy named Tom Glenn. I'm standing 6 inches away. And like, there was no... I was the most anonymous person, because, you know, which I get. I mean, I have good friends from my freshman year, but they're kids from BC. I mean, that's when you...
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, so it was a big deal to be getting this. My dad went to Tufts, but, you know, I resolved it just by saying, you know, I'm accepting the award because it's kind of decided. What, you know, what's the point in trying to make this more complicated? But there were certain ironies about it. And that's, again, I just didn't fit. I wasn't that well known. I hadn't done the things you usually do, and I had done some things you don't usually do.
Were you often in the paper? Did you write editorials, or
No.
Were you considered a rabble-rouser?
I was considered a rabble-rouser, but not because of writing, but we just did stuff. I mean, one of the things I did, I can't remember under which umbrella, but so there was kind of a boring lecture series that the student council used to run. So then they said to me, geez, can you, you know... So I invited Masters and Johnson Okay. Standing room only. I don't, I was thinking about this. I was like, how did I get these people? I don't know. But we did it.
In those days, you probably wrote a letter or called.
Yeah, exactly. We definitely wrote a letter. But I don't remember if I said, well.
Where were they, at Stanford or Princeton or something?
I think they were in St. Louis.
And do you remember the talk?
I remember nothing about the talk, but I remember standing room only. So that was like, wow. You know, and it sort of legitimized Tufts was, a first-class place because these were big celebrities, you know, at that
time. What were you looking to do with the suit? Did you?
I was just trying to create something interesting. I didn't have any particular perspective on the merits of anything they were going to say. But I just thought, well, university, what do you do? I kind of didn't know any better. And so that, some of those things, you know, Joanne Ross, Masters and Johnson. So for people who were paying attention, you know, but it wasn't like I was writing a lot of things or kind of out telling my story.
Yeah. Challenging the status quo.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Well, they saw something in you.
So it seems.
What do you think they saw?
I think it was, commitment to social justice and it's probably 90% of it and maybe 10% was, ability to get stuff done.
Mm-hmm. Why did you? I'm just curious. Why did you transfer from BC?
So I went to high school in New Jersey, and my guidance counselor told me that I was going to get accepted at Harvard and Yale. My grandfather went to BC, so my mother wanted me to apply to BC, which I didn't even think of it as a safety because this was like, oh, you guys. Well, I got on the wait list of both places. So then...
Oh, okay, you hadn't applied to Tufts.
No, I just, I didn't really...
Yeah, you're very young at that age, yeah.
Well, also, the guidance counselor was like, this is like, no sweat, okay, what do I know, So anyway, I got to BC, and I didn't have the best attitude because I was kind of disappointed. I had great friends, I had some great professors, but I was again saying to these guys, so every night at 11 o'clock a Jesuit priest came in my room to make sure I was in bed.
Aye, aye, aye.
4 years of required philosophy, 4 years of required theology. So 40% of your courses are, if you wanted to leave campus after 7 o'clock at night, you had to get permission from the dean of resident life, who was a Jesuit. So, academically, BC had really come a long way. Again, I was saying to these guys, there were kids in my, they had an honors program in my section. So one kid went, was accepted at Stanford, Harvard, came to BC. Another kid was accepted at MIT, BC, came to BC. So, but the rules, I didn't go to parochial school as an undergraduate.
Yeah.
So it didn't.
Very constrictive.
I couldn't kind of. So anyway, and since my dad had gone here and he was, a big fan, that's a great place.
Must have been a breath of fresh air to get to the Hill.
So yeah, so from my point of view, it was, it was a completely different philosophy.
Mm.
What do you want to change as opposed to, one of my friend's professors was a Jesuit, said in class one day, what's old is good, what's new is bad. That sort of, and now it's a totally different place now and it was changing then, but.
Yeah,
I just wasn't. So anyway, that's why I transferred.
Nice change for you. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. In terms of friends that you formed at Tufts, what kind of circles did you tend to gravitate toward?
I was thinking about this. Most of my friends, the people that I'm still very good friends with a guy named Michael Kerr, who Phil knows. He and I worked together in the Clinton administration, but he was in the class behind me. I was also very friendly with one of his classmates named Patty Jaffe, who lived in the French house with Erica Drazen, who committed suicide maybe 10 years ago, just in case you were going to try it out. Yeah. I was kind of a little bit friendly with the Ruskins. Barbara Ruskin graduated the year before. Her husband is a doctor. I kind of knew Erica because of the French house, because I kind of hung around with those guys. But like I said, you know, I wasn't ever really in residence in a way that you build a lot of relationships.
You were in any formal organizations or?
Not, well, the Experimental College.
SDS, but not
the student, whatever that lecture thing was, the Leonard Carmichael Society. So, you know, a few things, like you say, but...
there's no active... There was no student group that got formed specifically around civil rights.
I think we created something after the assassination called Students Concerned About Racism.
Okay.
But, you know, all these organizations, there was no...
Ad hoc kind of...
Right. You know... And none of them were sanctioned by...
Did you have a leadership role in any organization?
I don't, you know, not in a in an elected sense. It was just more, I knew how to get stuff done. Mm-hmm. So,
Did you have any favorite faculty?
So I didn't take any courses with Saul because, well, I didn't. I was an economics major. I took a seminar with Professor Badeau in social philosophy. I took a course in my senior year, because I had to take a course in arts, I think with Sylwan Barnett on the American Theater.
That's
something.
Been great, yeah.
I took Zella Luria's Introduction to Psychology. In the economics department, you know, I think, you know, I had Professor Ungen, Professor Holtzman. I mean, they're all good, but they were more, I would say, laid back. I mean, Zella Luria was a great lecturer, and Sylwan Barnett, you know, these are the...
Yeah.
And Badeau, there were like six of us, so that was pretty cool. But...
How would you describe their presence in your life? Were they energizing, or made you introspective about things that you hadn't thought about before, or?
Well, definitely Badeau and Luria. I mean, theater wasn't really my world, so I was interested, and he was a great, you know.
Did they open your eyes to something, or say, you know, hey, you know?
To be honest, a little bit more of that happened at BC, because, you know,
well,
freshman, sophomore...
Yeah.
And I had a roommate, you know, I arrived at BC with my Peter, Paul, and Mary record. And he's like, that is pop shit. Get that out of here. We're not, you know, if you don't have Bob Dylan, like, you're no one.
Oh.
So that was an education right there.
Oh. Did you agree?
Now, Bob Dylan, I believe, performed here.
Oh, really?
Like around 1962 or 3. There's a guy named Ray Duggan. Ray graduated, I forget, in like 66. And he put on, a Bob Dylan concert here. Like, when he, well, 62, 63. But I was not plugged into, anyway, so Jerry, my roommate, you know, there was an education. He had come from a parochial school, but he was very knowledgeable about things I never thought about, like jazz and popular music and, you know, and writers and poets and Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty and people that at Ridgewood High just had never come up. So, I mean, I had that experience, but it was more the first three semesters.
Do you think you changed a lot then between, by the time you graduated from Tufts?
I did. I mean, because I was pretty frustrated, unhappy guy the first three semesters. And here, it was like, you know, at BC, the favorite word is no. At Tufts, the favorite word was yes. I mean, they gave me a big scholarship my senior year. Now, part of it was financial aid for them, but they went way beyond what they... Because they wanted to have people who were asking questions.
Mm.
So, I mean, to me, that's important. There's a tendency to kind of focus a little bit on the protest, but to me... An equally important part of the story is the reaction and the lack of overreaction and the notion of, well, how can we learn from this? And, you know, the ex-college, which was a channel for a lot of this activity, and it kind of legitimized, I mean, not when, so much when I was there, but later, you know, there were courses that kind of could encapsulate the civil rights movement.
It's an interesting climate. It's an interesting So while you have that intense frustration and anger on the youth, you have a bricks and mortar institution who's saying, okay, how do we nimbly respond? We have no roadmap. We have no precedent. We have only 100 odd years of tradition behind us.
Well, and they had the New York Times, so they knew what was happening at Harvard, Columbia, Yale, BC. You know, I mean, there was a they knew they were all kind of going through the same thing in a sense, and in some instances, certainly at Harvard and Columbia, more drastic things than what went on here by far. So, and they're paying attention. I think Al Ullman was an important kind of leavening figure. And as I said, President Hollowell, who, you know, Central Casting send me a banker, but if you actually look at how he handled some of this stuff and who he put in these jobs, you know, when he made Tony Shays the dean of Jackson, that was about change. So they wanted to, you know, they were kind of embracing it. They were not trying to, you know.
Intuitive in some way, I think.
Yeah, that's a yes. I agree with that.
Yeah. And you can't buy that. I mean, that just has to come from within.
Right, because, you know, Hollowell, when he was selected, there was no way to predict that we would go through this kind of period in American society. You know, after I graduated, I got a couple of letters from him. There was a trustee named Max Tischler, who was, I think, the CEO of a big drug company. It was a very respectful dynamic, in my opinion.
Is there any singular meaningful moment or event that you remember that might stand out in the landscape of those experiences that you had here? I mean, is there one or two that you said, well, that was a great day, or that was a pretty tough day, but got through it? If not,
well, let me just say one more thing. So the graduation speaker my year was John Kenneth Galbraith.
Oh.
So that was, again, a statement about change. I mean, he was preaching economic equality for my former boss, Bob Reich. So I just, you know, I think there was, anyway, you know, it's be hard to top the Mr. Tufts episode because of all the weird things that happened around it. That was positive. I mean, there were a lot of people there, and, you know, people clapped, and there was nobody picketing, and, you know, but it was just because I've tended to be, you know, if you read one or two of my Globe profiles, I've tended to be more of a behind-the-scenes person than a... So this was not my usual...
It was nice that you were recognized.
Yeah.
So I guess I wondered if you... When you... Did you... If you have time for these two questions. How did you see your future when you... Do you remember... If you could travel back in time, do you remember being that guy graduating from college? How did you see your future? Did you see your place in the world as someone who would be, for lack of a better word, someone who would be an agent of change who would work for the greater good?
I did.
You did. You wanted to carry on.
Yeah, no, if you go back and read the various interviews during that period, I said I wanted to be a community organizer, which in that era was a, you know, Barack Obama said he was a community organizer, but he had a different definition. And Hillary Clinton wrote her senior thesis at Wellesley College on Saul Alinsky, who was the sort of preeminent community organizer in the country. So I'm just kind of putting
those
that.
Are role models. Yeah.
Well, so I, yeah. So in any event, so I wanted to pursue that. So that's how I kind of organized, to the extent I had discretion on my curriculum, you know, joined Ross. When I graduated, I became a VISTA volunteer for 2 years, mainly in South Boston, which was part of this, you know, the poor white people too. Then I spent a few years at Brandeis at the Heller School, which is a social policy, so I got my PhD there. So that was kind of another... then I spent 5 years at the Welfare Department, which was definitely working with folks. Even when I was at the MBTA, we had a program for the homeless, because there are homeless in train stations. When I went to work in the Clinton administration, I went to work for Bob Reich, who was the most liberal guy in the Clinton administration and a big champion of doing something about income inequality. There was a commitment to public service, but there was also a commitment to doing it in the context of some kind of social justice. And, you know, I mean, some of these might be a little bit of a stretch, but even at Partners, we did a lot with the neighborhood health centers and stuff. Mm-hmm. So
resonates still today.
Yes.
Young kids are coming into touch now.
Yeah.
The world's in a lot of stress over a lot of different kinds of issues, some of which are still ongoing, the poverty issues and hunger in America, among others. Any advice you would give to them today?
So, you know, before I took this job, I taught for 2 years at the Kennedy School. And I had a lot of... two of the four semesters I taught mid-career people, and then the other two semesters I taught kids right out of... they, in my experience, have a somewhat mechanical view of the labor market. So someone would come into my office and say, if I want to be Secretary of Health and Human Services in 20 years, should I take this summer job or that summer job? That's not really a made-up story. So he's like, and how I say to them, well, like, do what you want to do and do a good job. Doing a good job is more important than which job. I mean, you know, if you want to run an airport, should you go to School of Social Work? I don't know.
Who'd have thought?
I mean, it doesn't, but, you know, here I am. I think they, when I was here and, you know, I was arrested in the civil rights demonstration in the South End, it was in a parking lot that was used by John Hancock in 2001. I was made a member of the board of directors of John Hancock. Not because there's this kind of view, you know. But it's hard to convey that, I think, to kids because they're surrounded with kids who have the same worldview they do. And maybe it'll change in their generation. But, you know, it's like do the right thing and, you know, maybe things will happen.
Yeah.
As opposed to plot every step along the way.
I wonder where that mechanical is.
Well, it must come from the parents. I mean, I'm sure my kids are but it just doesn't apply to my generation. Maybe it will apply to
the trajectory is much more organic.
Right. You know, I mean, I worked at the North Suffolk Mental Health Center as a senior, and now I do a lot of work with people in East Boston.
Yeah.
So that helped me. I was a VISTA volunteer working with welfare recipients. I went to work at the welfare department. You know, even though you'd say in each instance, well, that doesn't lead to that.
Don't be so literal.
But it's not a, you know.
So I guess basically they need to pan back.
I think it'd be a little bit less calculating. Now, maybe these kids are different than the kids I had at the Kennedy School, but, you know.
Anything you'd like to add about your Tufts experience?
No, I had a great experience. My dad, you know, obviously had a great experience. I've stayed in touch with, through Saul a lot institutionally. Mm-hmm. I did some work with Larry Bacow when I was on a committee at Harvard that he was on. I've stayed in touch with Phil. I've stayed in touch with Michael Kerr. I mean, it had the same kind of, you know, mm-hmm. impact on my life that you would hope that a undergraduate experience would mm-hmm. have.
Definitely seems so.
And, he was saying walking down the hall, you know, I was the CFO at Brown for a couple of years. And so that gave me a kind of chance to see...
Under the hood.
Yeah. And also, you know, some of the values and stuff and the kind of different perspective. So it made me, you know, Brown's a great place. My daughter went there, you know, everyone who went there in the last 30 years. But It was just interesting to see, you know, Brandeis, Tufts, Brown, they each have their special
characteristics. Yeah, and I think as you're a college student, I mean, that's true today, too. The students are coming in with high expectations and impatient for change, and they look at this institution, Tufts, and have not a subtle understanding. They would never have the subtle understanding of process and trustees and bylaws and charters and all that stuff. So you butt up against that even today. But it sounds like the time in Tufts history you arrived was fortuitous in that you were able to
definitely
have windows and doors open to you.
Yeah, I mean, everything that happened to me here was very positive.
Excellent.
And so.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Anything else here, guys? Or
food in Carmichael Hall was much better than the food at BC.
The food in Carmichael was better.
Yeah, it was like night and day.
Makes you wonder why.
Well, BC was like a huge dining room. You know, it seemed like 800 people.
Oh, so they just did.
It was like
slop.
Tufts' first experiment in co-ed was my freshman year, fall of 66. They put us with upper-class women in DeWick, thinking that was safe, which is how I got to meet Judy Mears.
That was not safe.
She was a troublemaker.
Tom, look at the thing in the plastic envelope to the left of that gray folder.
Yeah, Phil just gave us that a few months ago.
Oh.
Signed by Judy Mears.
How do you have all these things? Like I said, he must have the biggest attic of anybody.
Oh, it's gone. I just sent two boxes of stuff to Berea.
Did we have it?
Berea? I like Berea.
They now have all my Eastern Kentucky Appalachia stuff. It's all gone.
Oh.